Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kendall Roden, Cynthia Krang, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, Russell Young, and Sajid DeMello discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please visit our website at azpodcast.com.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 241, being recorded on the 8th of August, 2018, with special guest Deep Kapoor. I'm Sajid, and on Skype with me, I have, Cynthia, Evan, Kendall, and of course, our special guest, Deep. And before we get to Deep, let's just do a quick roundup of all the latest news in the Azure space.
I'm going to have to do it just to tick Kale off. Right, this is a big week. We announced the Ethereum Proof of Authority on Azure, which has all kinds of performance enhancements and benefits to doing it in Azure. And since Kale's not here, we get to talk about blockchain.
And yeah, this was an interesting one. I actually also read up on this, Evan, and interesting. So, you know, from the way I understand it is that you can have a proof of work, right, which is the mining part that you typically do when you want to get involved in a blockchain transaction. And that typically involves, you know, number crunching, finding that magic number and whatnot. And then instead of that, and that's okay for a public blockchain, but when you have a private blockchain within a company or within a set of few companies that you trust, you don't have to do that, you know, very CPU-bound way of proving your worth on the network. And so you can just do proof of authority, which is a lot faster, obviously.
Right.
So it's really a great, I agree. It's a good update.
Yeah, and I'd be lying if I said I understood all the intricacies, but basically it was talking about because this is implemented within the Azure service itself, right, you get all kinds of the benefits of you're basically, you know, to Azure, you're staying local, right, you're not leaving the environment, all that kind of stuff, which gives additional perf benefits as well.
Yep. Great. What else do you guys want to talk about? Cynthia and Kendall, anything you guys like in this week's update?
So I'm just reading a little bit about this, that the Azure Reserve instances now gives you the availability for size flexibility. This is something I've been working with the customer that when they're trying to cut costs, Microsoft will usually recommend going with reserve instances if they know what type of VMs they want to use. But a lot of times this comes with, what if we do want to change up our sizing or which SKUs are available? So now with that, you're actually able to choose and change to sizes even after you've gone into reserve instances.
So, Cynthia, I'm trying to envision this. Like, the point of the reserved instance is, in essence, the value proposition is the customer says, hey, I'm going to absolutely pay for these. I'm absolutely going to use them. And then on the Microsoft side, we get to, in essence, that helps with our capacity planning over time, right? Because we know that these resources are going to be paid for.
Correct.
And but when you change sizes, there's a substantial discount for that, right? It's a pretty typical model, right? But by allowing, so today you're stuck with the SKU size, what, and maybe this is the cynic in me, but like what stops somebody from saying, hey, Microsoft, I'm going to buy these, you know, big VMs and I want this really the reduced price. And then you say, oh, I changed my mind. I'm going to do like this really tiny VM. Like it seems like we've kind of opened that feature up.
So there's still, I think, some restrictions on the VMs that still have to be within the same group.
Ah, gotcha. Okay.
So there's still some nuances within it, but it gives you more flexibility within the box.
Gotcha. Okay, so the box is a little bigger. Instead of being a little dot, it's a box now instead of.
Yes.
Okay, gotcha. Makes sense.
That was good. Yeah. What else? I know Ignite is coming along, right? And so definitely if you guys are into learning about Azure, learning about development, there's a lot of focus on code this time around in Ignite, September 24th to the 28th in Orlando. We'll put a link to that. I know Rob Karen, our senior product marketing manager, has put a post out there with Scott Hanselman. So we'll put a link to that. Anything else, you guys? I see some other updates over here.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're announcing, and now I'm starting to get confused, but we're announcing Windows Container support in Azure App Services. And now I'm starting to get confused about, where do I do my container? Do I do my container in Service Fabric, in AKS, or do I do it in App Services? I mean, I guess in some level I don't care, but...
ACI, Kubernetes, let me count the ways, hold on.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, in essence, we're turning it on so that whatever service you want to use, if you, what you want to deploy is containers, then you can do containers, in essence, instead of using the service natively.
Yes, and I think the big update from this week is that the Windows containers are supported. Is that the one you were talking about?
Exactly.
In services. So that's a big thing. Well, you know, we'll talk to Deep about that. I'm sure he has some thoughts about that as well in a bit. But so what else? And there was another update on Linux is now available for ASE, for the ASE environment, right? So as you know, ASE is our kind of your standalone app service environment. It's a little more expensive than the typical app service that you can spin up on Azure, but you get your own app service environment. It's not multi-tenant, it's just you. And now you could, do Linux with the ASE instead of just Windows like it was in the past. So.
Yeah, sorry, I joined a little late here. Did anybody get the blockchain news on?
Oh, yeah, we talked about that one to death, Kale. Awesome. We wanted to hit it ahead.
The very first thing
you hear that.
Evan picked it out of the hat right off the bat. You know?
That's great.
He's like, okay, Kale's not here. I'm going to take this one.
Trying to build my creds as a blockchain expert.
Nice.
Yes, it was a good update, though, Kale. Thanks for posting that. All right, and what else is out there this week? We talked about Windows Container, HD Insight, Query Tools, 10 tools to... Kale, you want to talk about this?
Yeah, I think the cool thing here is, like, looking at, if you're looking at these Hadoop or these HD Insight clusters that you can build in Azure, there's a bunch of... new ways to kind of query into these things, and it seems like it's getting a bit more interactive, which is really cool. So it used to be more like, hey, I have to go run this batch thing, and then I can go see what the results of that thing are, my aggregation. But a lot of work has gone into this, not just on the Microsoft side, but the open source side. Apache Zeppelin is quoted in here as a tool that you can use as well. There's a lot of stuff about VS Code and how those tie into this whole development ecosystem around being able to query your data in HD Insight to do these kind of really big queries over these large amounts of data. So I think the point here is there's a bunch of different ways to use these different tools now to be able to view that data or get an insights into that data, and it's kind of growing pretty fast, so it's good to be aware of all the different options you have there. To the point about containers, this is more on the how do I view my data or query my data. There's so many different ways now. It's becoming its own little thing over there to understand all those ways.
This kind of feels like the distinction between, I can write code to read and write data out of a traditional relational database, or I can use something like, Management Studio and the Oracle one escapes me. It's not PuTTY, but that's the SSH one. But, there's a third party kind of Oracle management tool, right, to go see your data without having to write code to see it. This feels very analogous to that environment.
Toad's one that comes to mind for
Toad,
me.
Toad, that's what I was trying to think about. Yeah, thanks. That's what I was trying to think about. Yeah.
Cool. And then
Toad.
in the past, Rob Caron, again, our the senior product marketing manager for Azure, he would produce these weekly updates. I think it was used to be called This Week in Azure or something like that. So they changed the name now. It's called Azure.Source is the new name. So there's a new volume out with all the volume 43 with all the latest updates, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Okay. I think that's a good roundup of all the latest. Let's get started with our special guest, Deep. Deep, thank you so much for joining us today. Why don't you give our listeners a little bit of an update about what you do at Microsoft and what your passion is in the Azure space, and then we'll just kind of take it from there.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here with you guys. So I'm Deep. I'm a PM or a program manager on the Service Fabric product group. So we work on a few different offerings in various spaces dealing with microservices and container orchestration, or more broadly speaking, application management and lifecycle management. And I've been involved with Service Fabric mostly through Service Fabric Mesh, which is something we'll be talking about more today, I imagine, which is our latest offering that we announced at Build, have previewed recently, and are making a lot of headway in, as well as on Service Fabric Standalone, which is a really interesting space personally for me, which is effectively Service Fabric running outside of Azure, I think is the easiest way to explain it. But it's effectively, you know, take the bits that Service Fabric has. It's what Azure runs on, it's what Microsoft runs on, it's all of our critical workloads, all of the stuff where we can't afford to lose anything. So all of these storage technologies that you guys just talked about, containers that we're orchestrating, things like that, these hypercritical deployments, get the technology for free, run it in your own data center or on your own devices in the case of, you know, a lot of movement on the IoT front, on the edge device front, and federate all these machines into a cluster on which you can then run workloads. So effectively bring your compute right to where, you know, the fingertips of where your data is actually being collected, and have that stuff come together.
Cool. You know, Deep, I got to start with asking you this one question. I mean, recently I've done a lot of work with Kubernetes, right? And I know that there is this weird relationship that Kubernetes has with Service Fabric. Obviously, sure. they do a lot of things. They don't do a lot of the same things, I should say. So give us an update as to where Service Fabric is right now. You know, before we get into Mesh, I understand that's the new fuzzy toy that we have here. But let's talk about just Service Fabric as a platform. Can you give us an update of where it is, in the kind of the evolution?
Absolutely.
And where we're going with it?
This is an absolute surprising question. I definitely did not expect to be asked anything of the sort. The one thing I want to make clear before we start is when we think about container orchestration as Azure, what we're working towards is being the best place for you to run your containers. So really, one step away from even the orchestrator that you choose, whether or not you come in with an opinion, we want to make sure that you can find the right place. And I know you guys were joking about this earlier, but we have a myriad of places now, right? And sort of the goal with that is to find like the exact situation which matches your need, whether that's based on the scale that you're operating at or the costs or the amount that you want to be invested in the actual pipeline and the deployment process for running your workloads. Now, more specifically, we've been investing quite heavily both in Service Fabric as well as in Kubernetes. And Kubernetes is this awesome, you know, community coming around. It's a fully open source product. It's been really great to see, one, how much progress it's made in the last couple of years, and two, and this is more interesting for us, is how much attention it's bringing to the space of container orchestration and application management when applications, whether or not they're in the form of microservices, are deployed through containers. Service Fabric, as you said, does do similar things, but there is a decent amount of differences between the two. So first off, I mean, Kubernetes is a container orchestrator. What that means is you come with a set of containers and you are provided in an environment in which you can schedule the deployment of these orchestrators. You can scale them, and then you can plug and play with a bunch of different great integrations that are available in the public to build out a true or seemingly true PaaS for yourself in combination with numerous technologies. So you may want to bring in something like Istio, or you want to bring in your own monitoring suite with Fluentd or Grafana, things like that. To plug and play and create an environment in which you can now run these containers at scale in a production-grade environment. Service Fabric, on the other hand, is an alternative approach. It tends to be more of an integrated solution where we're like, look, we know a user has a set of problems that they're going to need to find solutions for in order for them to have a production-ready environment. And we've gone and made some decisions, and we're like fairly opinionated on what might be a good way to solve these problems. So look at routing. Look at managing health and status of containers, looking at rolling upgrades, automated failover, things like that. And we've implemented what we feel is the right way or a good way to solve these problems. And effectively what that means is when you stand up a Service Fabric environment, you don't actually need to combine it with numerous technologies in order to set it up for yourself. And that's speaking just for container orchestration. What's more interesting is that we don't just support containers. And for those of you that are familiar with our history, Service Fabric was primarily built as a microservices orchestrator, if I can call it that. containers to us are more of a deployment mechanism in a sense, because the goal is that you have some kind of workload that needs to run. So our goal is to make sure that we're able to run any kind of application in any cloud on any operating system. So what that means is whether or not you're running in containers, we will still give you all of the benefits for orchestration. So you can come as a native .NET application, a .NET Core application, a Java application, or what we call a guest executable, which is effectively any kind of process, any .exe that can be triggered with a script. Or sure, if you've gone to containerizing, then we're happy to accept that as well as an alternative form of deployment. And then the last sort of piece I want to call out is that Service Fabric is more than just an environment in which you could run your applications in. We sort of bleed a little bit above the infra and the platform layer, a little bit into the app and the architecture layer as well, in terms of how you design your actual solution based on your business needs. So we have these things called the Service Fabric programming models. They're effectively our implementation of an actor model and a reliable service model, which leverages stateful computation the way Service Fabric has done it, which is primarily built for storage technologies like Cosmos DB, SQL Storage, things like that in Azure, with the goal that in the case that you are architecting fresh or you're architecting a new piece for whatever your workload looks like, you can leverage Service Fabric state awareness through our programming models and import that into your code. So it can affect the way you actually write your code and optimize your code to run on clusters that are running Service Fabric.
I had one question around that then too. So this is Kale. I work a lot with Kubernetes as well and containers in general. And I'm aware of like the last part you spoke about there around Service Fabric. I'm not as in tune with the mesh stuff and even some of the container support you have here. But the deep, like where you're writing programs like, reliable collections and things like that, those kind of things I was aware of. But my question is specifically if I have a scenario where a couple companies are going to be building stuff that are going to integrate together potentially, and they have like containers, is it possible to take a container that runs in Kubernetes and just bring that and say, well, we don't use Kubernetes maybe in our infrastructure as company A, we want to use Service Fabric to do that, and we'll just take that build pipeline and run our stuff this way. Other people could be running Kubernetes, but we're both using kind of the same containers. Is that real? Like that's the model?
Absolutely it is, yeah. So, I mean, the containers that we typically see in industry today are what we call Docker containers. So this is almost 5 years ago at this point where this idea was introduced of containerizing workloads. And it came in the form, or I guess it came from a company named Docker. And that's sort of what's been popularized over the last couple of years. And effectively what's happening is Service Fabric, as well as Kubernetes, are just using a bunch of APIs that effectively create what is the container runtime or triggers the container to actually be launched and run. And we have our own wrappers around the experience, but at a very low level, it's the same thing that's happening with just orchestrating Docker containers. So if you have an image that is a Docker container image that you're currently running in a Kubernetes cluster, you can most definitely run the exact same image in a Service Fabric cluster. The difference would be in the way in which you describe exactly how you want to deploy that image and how you want it to run. So say you want 5 instances or 10 instances, suppose you want to do a combination of that image with other things, how you choose to describe that application or that deployment will be different because, Kubernetes has a notion of charts. We have manifest files, we have deployment.json files, and we do support Docker Compose as well, which is something you can use in Kubernetes land as well as in Docker Swarm, which is their clustering technology. And so, yeah, most definitely. And we do see a lot of people do this, especially when they think about multi-OS environments, because Kubernetes is still working towards, supporting Windows in a stable way. And it's completely possible.
So, Evan, you had a question, right? You were going to ask something?
My question was, like, when I hear the description that Deep's giving about kind of, the environment and how Service Fabric works, especially the part, Deep, where you were talking about reaching up into the application layer, that sounds like, I guess what I'm trying to get my head wrapped around, and this is sort of to Kale's question as well, I think, it like what decision points or decision questions should I ask myself to decide, hey, I want to write my application kind of being Service Fabric aware and take advantage of some of the optimizations versus just put it in Service Fabric so I get the benefits of Service Fabric without really having to worry about the fact that I'm in Service Fabric, right? Because that's going to impact the amount of effort I put into and kind of some of my design decisions.
Absolutely. That's a great question. So if you'd indulge me for a second here, Service Fabric was built several years ago, and it was kept internal for the most part and publicized only about 3 years or so ago and made publicly available after that in the form of, you know, what we call GAs at Microsoft.
Yeah.
And the reason it was built was to find a scalable way to support Azure storage technologies in a way that we could co-locate the compute and the data to reduce latency, to increase reliability and increase consistency. So those were the initial sort of goals paraphrased. And that's, you know, how Azure SQL is built, how Cosmos DB is built. And these services effectively are what we call Service Fabric stateful services. And they take advantage of our reliable collections and our reliable services programming models. And the reason they do that is because they are aware of the fact that they've made the conscious decision that they need to have stateful computation that's provided to them via the platform they're running on. And so if you're thinking about this, you can sort of go through the same decision process, which is effectively based on your application, based on your business need. If you feel like you need to have stateful computation or you need to have access to data in memory while you're actually running your processing or your compute, then it becomes more interesting to consider stateful services the way Service Fabric does them. And in that case, you would want to consider looking into our reliable services, for example, where you have the option to effectively use data structures which are similar to what you're used to seeing in other programming languages, like dictionaries. So we have a reliable dictionary, we have a reliable queue, and a reliable concurrent queue. These are the three data structures we have within what we call the reliable collections. And effectively, you can embed these and swap out the data structures that you were previously using, and where in a more what we call a stateless architecture, you might have stored stuff into a data structure and then exported that state to a external store. So you may be using SQL or Redis cache or something like that, which takes advantage of the fact that you can trust somebody else with your data. Or you could say that you want to have access to the data right away exactly where you are, whether that's to reduce latency or to make sure that you're having consistency across your entire platform. And those are the scenarios in which I would say you should start considering letting Service Fabric help you optimize the way in which you're solving your problem. But that doesn't mean...
So it sounds like, I guess the scenario you're talking about sounds like it's a pretty easy onboarding. Say, hey, I'm using a dictionary, I'm using some sort of collection already, but now I don't have to worry about, if I put it on top of Service Fabric, I get the stateful nature of it just by changing my object type rather than having to add another layer of code that says, hey, go persist this data somewhere.
Yes, correct. Exactly what it is. So you'd be importing, our NuGets so that you're taking advantage of the fact that our runtime is running alongside your workloads, and then you'd change your data structure type from being a dictionary to like an iReliable dictionary, which is our way of declaring that.
Right.
And then you have additional knobs that you can turn in terms of how you want us to handle things, whether you want us to allow certain conditions, like for example, in the case of a stateful Service Fabric service, there's this notion of a replica set, which is effectively I need to have a minimum of 3 or a minimum of 5 replicas that are running that I can fail over to at all times if anything goes wrong with one of my replicas. And in that 5, we have a notion of a primary replica, and then we have secondaries. The primary replica is the one that's responsible for doing reads and writes, but we allow you to turn knobs like you want to do a read from a secondary, which has risk, but could also be advantageous in the case of, really, really low latency. And I'm not talking like seconds, I'm talking microseconds, milliseconds. These are like financial companies that want to have really fast transactions. They're the ones that I see like taking advantage of things like this a lot of the time. Gaming companies will also take advantage of a stateful service a lot because they need that consistency across the set. And you guys seem to be familiar with the blockchain. So there's this notion of, there's a quorum effectively that's established inside a cluster, and you need to have consensus, and it's consensus driven to guarantee the fact that when new data is coming into an application that's running as a stateful Service Fabric service, at all points, every single replica that is considered up to date, or effectively a quorum of those replicas are greater than half, which is has the same amount of data, then we can say that something's truly been committed to the cluster, and we can guarantee that if there's anything wrong with your primary replica, we can fail over to a secondary that is up to date and has the exact same info in it, thereby guaranteeing you a lot more reliability and consistency. And that is why these storage technologies use Service Fabric, because effectively, you know, if you're writing an application with an architecture where you're persisting your state in Cosmos DB, for example, they're orchestrating it using a reliable collection. So they're effectively getting you the same reliability, but you're basically saying, I don't want to have to worry about re-architecting what I'm doing.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Yep. Thanks, Deep. So tell us about this mesh thing. I've been hearing a lot about it, and I'm kind of very anxious to know what it does and what it brings to the table, because I think it seems like a lot of people, there's a lot of buzz around it, and seems like it's a big game changer. So give us a skinny on that, please.
Sure. Yeah. So we've been running Service Fabric clusters for a long time, and you know, with the advent of container orchestration in general in the industry, people are starting to adopt it and set up clusters, whether that's Service Fabric or Kubernetes or Mesosphere or Swarm and countless other technologies, where you're now responsible for setting up your infrastructure. And then what ends up happening are people are like, oh, you know what, this is hard. I don't want to have to deal with setting up my infrastructure and managing this other clustering technology on it. So as a result, companies like Microsoft, Amazon, Google invest in building managed experiences. So if you run Service Fabric on Azure, if you run AKS, which is Azure Kubernetes Service, we're effectively managing the deployment of the service that's turning your set of machines into a cluster, thereby reducing some level of friction for running on this long term. Mesh is sort of born out of the idea that even that sometimes may not be required, or even that might be too hard, or that might not be something you want to invest time in, just simply because you don't need that level of access to the underlying machines, or you don't need that level of granularity in the amount of permissions that you need or have for your application to run successfully. And what I mean by that is sort of we're headed toward this new era where a lot of things are running in a serverless manner, which effectively means you don't have access to the underlying server. So you don't care about the infrastructure, you just want your stuff to run. And as long as it can run in a secure, isolated way, you're comfortable with that and you're okay letting somebody else handle it. And bringing these two ideas together, we built Service Fabric Mesh as a fully serverless Service Fabric environment where we own these giant clusters. So we've got huge clusters in multiple regions, thousands of cores, and we're bearing the full responsibility now of both maintaining Service Fabric on those machines, but also the underlying infrastructure, so that you as a user only have to come with your application and can focus purely on your application development. And what that means is, as you were alluding to earlier, you come with your set of containers, you let us know how you want them to be done, and we will run them for you in a hardened environment that we trust inside this company as well as outside in many other companies as well, without you having to bear any operational overhead whatsoever.
So this is like a multi-tenant Service Fabric environment? Is that the good way to describe it?
Yeah, multi-tenant Service Fabric environment where you have no visibility into the underlying platform of the infrastructure.
Okay, and you mentioned we can bring containers to you, but can we also bring a stateful service, for example?
So you could bring a stateful service inside a container in the way that it's been done right now. So for now, what we're doing is just purely container orchestration. So you'd effectively have your .NET service. You'd use our very nifty Visual Studio tooling to dump that into a container with about two clicks, and then you'd be able to deploy that without having to do any further modifications.
Okay, so this is taking what Evan just said, is have a container, I want to run it somewhere, and just bring it in, you can run it in Service Fabric now.
Exactly. And now you don't have to worry about, you know, either finding yourself a cluster or having to get three or five machines or whatever is required wherever you're running your actual applications. You can instead just pay based on your resource utilization, as is the case usually with serverless models where you're paying based on how much compute you're taking up and for how long. Mesh is effectively the same thing, where you're just paying for the cores that you're reserving for your applications and for how long your applications have actually been deployed. And that's really interesting now for people who don't want to deal with operational overhead, because traditionally what we've seen in the serverless world has been a lot of burst computation or scheduled computation, or these scripts that need to run at a certain amount of time, or trigger-based and event-based computation. So if you look at Lambdas from AWS or functions from Azure, a lot of that is shorter running tasks that can come to completion. You can spawn multiple instances of them, and they sort of do their thing, and then they go away, and you just pay for the time that they were up. And a mesh is interesting because it basically creates an environment in which, for the first time, you have all of that upside of not worrying about the underlying platform and the infrastructure, but you can actually deploy your long-running production environment there. So why just have burst and scheduled compute in a serverless environment when you can have everything in a serverless environment and not have to worry at all about VMs, at all about your operating system patches, at all about the fact that service fabric might be clustering those VMs?
Okay. And how does this distinguish from ACI, for example?
So ACI was a really cool sort of innovation that we had at Azure, which was mostly motivated by getting people to try containers. And it was it's a great opportunity for people to get used to deploying in containers, testing containers. And it's also given us a great environment to innovate more and more around the notion of containers. So you're bringing up a container, orchestrating it in a single machine, and then getting you to do a lot of things around it and getting us to build a great platform to do that was where sort of ACI is meant to be. But the moment you think about, you know, multi-service applications that require several instances that need to run constantly, or more interestingly, things like routing. So Mesh and Service Fabric both have a inbuilt service mesh. And this is confusing because Service Fabric Mesh has a service mesh in it, which effectively means you have service-to-service communication. You have ingress. You have a bunch of routing rules. You can do what we call blue-green deployments. You have all these options that suddenly become the case because you're in a multi-machine environment at a large scale, but you don't really care about the fact that you are. You just have all those options. Whereas with ACI, it's more about single instance. It's Azure Container Instances. Right. Yes.
Okay. Now that's very good. And so from a developer perspective, you still have to bring a bunch of containers in. And how do the containers, like you said, the service discovery or something, how do the containers talk to each other?
So we are working with Envoy. So for those of you that aren't familiar, Envoy is Lyft's open source networking and routing technology. And we're effectively integrating that into Service Fabric. So basically, you don't have to do anything for service discovery or for service communication. You just need to be aware or make a decision in the way in which you will find the appropriate endpoint. So you can either just describe to us, say, hey, I'm looking for this container running inside this service, inside this application. Or if you want, you could also use ports, considering we'll be giving an IP per deployment or per application, and you can map a container listener to a specific port. And that's effectively where your responsibility ends. So just in when deploying, you describe to us, you know, if you want a container to map to a particular port, if you'd rather use service discovery, and then we just handle it from there because we already have everything set up in the environment. So it's not about setting it up, it's more about describing it correctly and then making sure your code actually executes on it the way that you described.
And this is both Windows and Linux at this time?
Yeah. So our preview is both Windows and Linux, and we will continue working on both because we've seen that people have been using both, and there's a need in the industry for both.
That's great. Well, I have one more question for Deep, but I want to give others a chance to ask if they have any questions.
So I had one about if we had a legacy application and we wanted to start trying out microservices, is there a way that Service Fabric or Service Fabric Mesh could kind of work in a hybrid solution of having something that is still legacy and something that's in microservices?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that we like to talk about a lot when we speak with our users is the Service Fabric Continuum, as we call it, which is effectively the fact that we accept really any kind of workload. So if you have something that executes today, that's all you really need to have all the orchestration benefits that we offer to you, as long as you just package it and describe it to us in the way that we are now aware of the fact that, hey, this is an executable. I want you to orchestrate it. I want 5 instances. And if you're able to describe that to us, which is relatively trivial, we are able to run it the way that you want. So what that means is if you are starting out with a large legacy application, you can just come to Service Fabric without changing anything about your code, as long as obviously you can get the whatever dependencies are required onto those machines. So without changing anything about your code, and it's going to run perfectly fine at scale with the reliability that we promise. And that starts to become interesting because nowhere in Service Fabric is there a requirement that you must deploy things of the same type. So what that means is, say you've come with this legacy application, now you want to add a second component. And we actually had like companies do exactly this, like Alaska Airlines, for example, had their website, alaskaairlines.com, put into a Windows container without changing any code and then running on Service Fabric. And now as they add additional components, they effectively write them in a more microservices way, and they run alongside this application. Now, whether or not it's in a container is a choice that's up to you. We don't particularly care. But because it's running the same environment, it has the same network, it has the same routing capabilities between this new microservice instance that's running around and the main legacy application, you're able to do that. And that's really cool for people who are still dealing with legacy code bases or large code bases that haven't been changed in a while, or large monolithic applications that may be more recent, but were monolithic for whatever reason, and they choose to modernize their application. And that horizon is never 2 months. You know, that horizon is years. And a lot of the time people feel like an inhibition toward moving towards something like Service Fabric or Kubernetes, where they're like, oh, no, I need to first like redo my entire app. I need to re-architect this to be microservices. Then I have to put it in containers. Then I'll be able to deploy it. But with Service Fabric, that's not the case, right? Because you can take advantage of the environment that would be the same environment that you'd be running in once you've done all the steps, but you can take advantage of using it right away. And that means you can deal with all the operational stuff that that you would have to down the line and set yourself up for success down the line without changing anything in your application and focus just on getting the environment right. And once the environment is running the way that you want, you can start modernizing your workload. So add microservices, split up the thing that you've put in, put them in containers, take them out of containers, use the Service Fabric stateful services, and the developer collections or not. All of this stuff runs at scale with reliability, consistency, and all the other promises of the Service Fabric platform right off the bat. And what's even more interesting is when you start considering these companies that have these large applications that are running currently on-prem, and they're like, okay, I need to eventually move to the cloud, but I have to do all this stuff before I move to the cloud. Service Fabric proposes this interesting scenario where you can effectively stand up a Service Fabric cluster in your database completely on-prem, running completely free, and it mimics and behaves the exact same way in which Service Fabric would behave in any other place. So whether it's another public cloud or in Azure, you are already using the environment that you think you're headed towards, which then means you're setting yourself up for success down the line, 2 years down the line, 3 years down the line, when you decide to go into production with a brand new re-architected way running on Azure. And you can start developing that environment today. So your developers are familiar with it, your ops folks are familiar with it, and you're not putting yourself in a situation where you're suddenly done re-architecting everything and you're like, damn, this doesn't work the way that I expected it to work in Service Fabric. So that's cool. And with Mesh, that's interesting because if you do decide to take the step of containerizing your workloads as they are, whether they're large legacy monolithic applications or not, you can do the exact same thing, which is just deploy them and then continue to modify them over time.
That's great, Deep. So I just want one final question. I know we're kind of taking too much of your time today already.
No worries.
So, you know, I've heard that Service Fabric is going open source, so is already open source. Can you kind of clarify for us which parts of Service Fabric are open source and which are not?
Yeah, sure. So Service Fabric as a code base has been open source. So effectively what we did is we said, here's our entire code base, which, by the way, fun fact, is the largest set of code we have ever open sourced as a company in Microsoft and as Microsoft. Service Fabric's code base is actually larger than the entirety of .NET, which is fascinating. Yeah, but we dumped all of our code in the GitHub repo. And so the pieces that are really actually there are, one, our Service Fabric services, so reliable services and actors. That stuff was open sourced about a year plus ago. So that's in one GitHub repo, and then we have github.com/Microsoft/Service-Fabric. That one has Service Fabric with all of its bits in it, but with build instructions just for Linux, because we're trying to figure out something in a build pipeline on the Windows side that will make it easier for people outside Microsoft to build Service Fabric for themselves on Windows. Now, there needs to be a distinction between what open source means and what open development means, because often people construe the two. Where sure, all of our code is available online and you can access it and you can, you know, do PRs to it. We're still largely working as a team that isn't fully, you know, transparent in the open environment. And so that's what we're working towards now, which is effectively, can we move our engineering systems, even though we are a team in Microsoft, in a way that's fully open, fully transparent and engaging with the community so that they're aware of what we're working on while we're working on it, as opposed to when we suddenly finished it, gave them a release note and dumped it in the repo. So we open sourced on Pi Day of 2018, and now we're actively working toward re-architecting ourselves, if I can call it that, and putting ourselves in a much more open and available environment. And it's been really awesome, actually. The journey has been really great for us. It's changed a lot of the way we like to think about things. It's also improved the way in which we as a product team make decisions about the product. It's helped us engage with the community better. And I think we got our first PR from one of our fans, Marcin, in 4 hours of the base open sourcing. So that was pretty cool as well.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for bringing us up to date on Service Fabric. I know we haven't had much Service Fabric discussion on the show for a long time, so appreciate you bringing us up to speed and all the great stuff happening in Mesh, and best of luck to all of those services in Azure and your team.
Yes, thank you so much.
If there's any resources you want to share with the listeners, please send them to me. Yeah. I'll put them along with the show notes, okay?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Steve.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.